I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS.
They say there's nothing new under the sun, and ain't that the truth? The Working Songwriter has been on the air for over 10 years and over 300 episodes now. As you've probably noticed, only the latest 100 published episodes are available in your podcast app and on Spotify. So, we're bringing back some of the gems from past years. Of course, if you want access to every single episode of the show at any time, you can become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website, joepugmusic.com, where you can access any episode of the show for streaming and for download. In the meantime, we're bringing back some classic episodes to the main feed. Is that a reason not to join The Vault? Of course not, because it means that our latest episodes will only be paywalled all the sooner. Is this a relatively convoluted system? Of course it is. But such are the trade-offs that the ever-changing media landscape leaves us to navigate. Thank you for being here. It's always an honor that you listen to this show, and I hope you enjoy some of these classic episodes. Today's show with Allison Russell was originally aired on June 18th, 2021. I hope that you enjoy the show. Our guest this week is no stranger to our program. Allison Russell is an alumnus of our podcast, having already appeared on the show once as one half of Birds of Chicago. But she joins us today on Her Lonesome in the wake of her critically acclaimed debut solo album. Born in Quebec, Russell endured a traumatic childhood of abuse and struck out on her own into the world as only a teenager. In the early 2000s, she burst onto the Canadian folk music scene with her band Po Girl, and then later continued her career with partner JT Nero in the band Birds of Chicago. More recently, she teamed up with fellow songwriters Rhiannon Giddens, Amethyst Kaya, and Layla McCalla to form the group Our Native Daughters. She's recorded for Network, Signature Sounds, Smithsonian Folkways, and Fantasy Records. She's appeared on Jimmy Kimmel Live. Rolling Stone has said that her solo debut reckons with traumatic history and chooses joy. NPR has said of her artistry, "She's proved that her voice can carry a story of tremendous weight and command the spotlight in the revelatory telling of it." And Variety has said of her most recent work, "It might be premature to proclaim Allison Russell's solo debut the album of the year, but it sure has the inside track." Allison is a friend of mine, and it was great to catch up with her a few weeks ago to hear about her new direction and her new artistic path. Allison Russell, thanks so much for coming back on to the Working Songwriter podcast. This is by no means your first project, and it's by no means your first solo project, but it's the first time, I believe, that you're writing and recording under your own name. Is that correct?
It's true. So it is my first solo project, I would say that, but it's by, you're right, far from my first project.
What made it time to do it under your own name right now?
I think it was a slow sort of a culmination of a lot of little urgencies that then suddenly became irrefutable and I couldn't push the river back anymore. I think that it really, the genesis of Outside Child really started with the project and record that I made with a group called Our Native Daughters, which is Rhiannon Giddens and Amethyst Kia and Layla McCalla and me. And we made a record called Songs of Our Native Daughters that came out early in 2019. And in it, we were kind of exploring stories of the Black diaspora from a Black woman's perspective and using the banjo as a primary writing medium. But during the course of that exploration, I ended up kind of delving deeper into my own paternal lineage. I didn't grow up with my biological paternal family. I met them as an adult. And that's been sort of a whole journey of discovery. And I learned about one of my ancestors as far back as we can trace, the great matriarch of our paternal lineage, who was a woman named Kashiba, who was kidnapped somewhere in West Africa and sold off the coast of Ghana and, you know, survived the Middle Passage and survived multiple sales and, you know, violations I can't even really begin to imagine, and her children being taken and sold. But she somehow survived all of that and ended up on a plantation in the north of Grenada and founded, you know, our lineage, our paternal lineage. And learning her name sort of shortly before I went in to do that project was really powerful for me. And I ended up writing a song in her honor called Kashiba. And the other part of that was it helped me understand the context of my own personal history, my own childhood history, and realized that sort of what had happened to me was not in a vacuum, that it was connected to and sort of part of this continuum of intergenerational trauma. And I really had this sudden urgency as now a mother myself to be part of stopping that cycle of violence, not just for myself and my child, but to try and stop that cycle of violence, period. And the beginning of that is talking about it. You know, it flourishes, that kind of cyclical intergenerational violence flourishes with our silence. And so I felt like, you know, I only have a few skills in the world, and that, you know, what the only thing I have to throw at any problem really are songs. And so that's what I did. I just started writing my own story and trying to treat myself, my own past self, as a beloved character instead of someone I was ashamed of.
Recognizing the full scope of that, I believe what you called was sort of an intergenerational history of violence within your family, I could see that affecting a person in one of two ways. Either it's very depressing to think about it, or in other ways, it's, I wouldn't say liberating, but it's maybe you felt less alone because of it. How would you say that you experienced that realization?
I think that's really astute, Joe. I think I did feel not only less alone, but also compared to every woman before me in my entire lineage, I have more agency and support and love and care surrounding me than any woman before me in my entire line. And so in that way, I also felt galvanized. You know, I have resources that they didn't have. And the fact that they survived what they did, I mean, I think that's true of all of us, frankly. And no matter what our, you know, sort of lineages or heritages or backgrounds or family histories or personal circumstances, whatever they are, we are all of us living on the planet now, the culmination of long lines of survivors who lived through times harder than me. You know, just that's just true of all of us. And I think that there's strength to draw from that, particularly when we're going through difficult times ourselves. And I think that it is empowering in that sense of knowing they survived what they did means we can get through anything. And it also means that there has been progress. Things are better with each generation. It's really easy, I think, because of the kind of conjunction of the way technology has sped up and the kind of the social experiment, you know, of social media, and that every bad thing gets amplified billions of times more than any good thing, because that just, you know, I don't know, it's like an evolutionary defense mechanism gone awry, you know, Like, we amplify negative things, and people just can't help themselves. I mean, we saw that for 4 years of the last administration. You know, people couldn't stop giving that guy free press, you know? And it was like, even knowing by doing that, you're helping a cause you don't support, right? And I just think that's an interesting thing. Like, but it's not true, right? That's a distortion of the reality. The reality is that we are living in a time that is more peaceful, that is more equal, that is less bigoted, that is less violent than at any time in human history prior. Like, we haven't like reached nirvana yet. We have a long way to go before there's every human is treated equally on the planet, but we have come a long way. And I think that is part of, like, when we hide from the past, not only does it not go away, you know, that, like, the truth will always out, but it also stops us from seeing the progress we've made and stops us from having that feeling of hope from the progress that we've made.
It's funny, you were saying that in some ways that kind of focus on the negative can sometimes be an artifact of just the technology or the medium by which we get information. But as you were talking about that, I realized how, as a person, I'm very personally complicit in that, because I tend to, especially as a parent now, I tend to seek out information that is bad or could be harmful, because as a parent, I'm like, all right, if something's going okay, then it needs none of my attention right now, right? So as a dad, I'm always searching out, like, what could be the problem next? And maybe since I'm doing that, I'm clicking on certain articles or listening to certain shows. And that gives a feedback loop of, like, all right, what I want is negative things. You know?
Right. I know. Isn't that a fascinating? I am right with you. And as a mom, and especially when I was pregnant, I went so far down the rabbit hole of every terrible thing that could happen, every birth pathology, every, you know.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where, like, I was making myself sick, and JT, you know, my partner, was like, "You gotta, like, find this. Let's put this in perspective. How many women have perfectly regular pregnancies with no complications?"
Right.
The majority, you know. But we do that. It's a funny thing. I feel like that is, we sort of get prodded into that by even the way we treat, you know, birth and parenthood is like these treacherous, you know, full of pathology and things that can go wrong. And if you do this to your kid is screwed for life. And if you do, you know, if you do that. And it's like, there was an Onion article that I read when I was pregnant that made me laugh so hard and kind of, like, shifted how I was thinking about all of it. And it was like, study shows that every child, no matter what, and I'm not quoting it properly, it's not nearly as funny when I paraphrase, but no matter what style of parenting, children feel totally fucked up by their parents.
You know? Right.
Like, right. It doesn't matter what you do or don't do. Like, they, not that that's completely true, but, like, if you love your child and you're there for your child, you are already winning, you know, and they are winning. Like, you are present, you are loving them, you are actively trying not to harm them, you know.
That's yes.
Whatever else happens, whatever the specifics, fine. And I started to, so I did, I forced myself, I started watching, obsessively watching videos of women giving natural birth really easily, you know, and making poor JT watch them too. But it was so, it really shifted something. Suddenly I was like, okay, I don't need to be afraid of this. Like, women have been doing this for millennia, you know, just fine. And yes, of course, thank goodness for modern obstetrics when something does go wrong. You know, yes, we need that, but we don't have to fear it. And I read this book called The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinkerton. And that was so helpful because he's a historian. He works at Harvard and he really looks at stats throughout history and he just breaks it down. He's like, we feel like we are in danger all the time because of these feedback loops that we are now in with, and the unprecedented thing of, like, being able to know about every bad thing that happens around the world instantly, you know, in a moment. And as you say, it's like, as a parent, where most of the time you're like, everything's fine, you don't need to worry about it. And then it's those moments where you do have to worry about it that become sort of amplified and dominant. And it's a similar thing where it's not like we have 24-hour good news networks, you know, we have 24-hour bad news networks, you know, there's not like huge articles about all the things going right everywhere.
But you know, if there were networks that did show that, all of us, I think all of our reaction would be like, this is a bunch of propagandistic bullshit. You know what I mean? If it was 100% right.
Like the constant negative stuff, which is also propaganda.
Exactly.
Bullshit, right?
Exactly.
It's like, I know, it's so funny. And it is, it's like, fine, because I am not advocating like, pretend everything's fine, ignore all the bad things in the world. That's not what I mean. I just mean we have to look at it in the context of history, and we have to look at it as we are making progress. And that should give us hope to keep pushing for that progress, you know, that yes, it does work. And forming coalitions of, you know, the loving and the willing and the, tolerant is not a word I'm interested in. Like, humans don't need tolerance. You know, we tolerate mosquitoes. You know,
right.
Humans require love. Like, I want to see us pushing for a world where we, and it's hard. It's like, how do you love the person that doesn't even think you're human? You know, but
right.
We have to get there. We have to get there of like compassion, at least for that person who is a walking wounded person, you know, and even if their walking wounded takes the form of being really, really hateful to a whole bunch of people. They are still a human themselves that is requiring some sort of compassion, you know?
It's yes.
Like, and that's the hardest part. And that was part of this journey for me of Outside Child, was that reckoning for myself with my own history, with my own adoptive father, you know, who was my primary abuser, but who is also my father. That is the man who raised me. And I loved that man. As much as he tortured and hurt me for a decade, I also loved him. You know, he raped me every night, but he also taught me to love my mind and love reading and wrote me an algebra book when I was struggling with algebra. You know, I mean, so he was a monster and he was also my father, you know, and he was an abused child himself. It's like things that we want things to be black and white, and they never are. And it's never simple, and it's never just like, yes, it was all bad. It's never all bad, and it's never all good, you know?
You're talking about a level of forgiveness there that I can barely understand, even in theory. I mean, it's almost happening on a completely metaphysical and almost religious level to be able to have that much forgiveness to somebody who did something so unspeakably evil to you.
Well, it's interesting that you say metaphysical, because I think about that a lot. I'm a, you know, I was a nerdy child. I'm a nerdy woman. And I love these, that how close, like physics now, when I read about quantum physics or like, it is metaphysical. It's like the multiverse, folded layers of time and space and reality and matter and energy overlapping each other. And this notion, I really have this feeling, and I had this feeling writing the record of that child that I was is still present. You know, that we all are. We all have that inner child that still exists. And I don't think it's just a psychological kind of trope. I think it's a real thing that there's moment, and we get transported sometimes to those moments of where suddenly we're right back there. And I think that that is true of everybody. I think that's true of my adoptive father. I think the abused child that he was very much present and informing everything that he did to me. Like, he brought that forward. He was raised, he was born in 1936 in a town in Indiana called Monticello that was a sundown town, like
right.
On the books, a sundown town until the 70s, like 78.
Wow.
You know, I'm born in 79.
Right.
Like he was brought up in a town that was like, if you are a person of color, if you are a black person, you cannot spend the night or you will be lynched and the law will be on the lyncher's side,
right.
You know? And it was like, that he was so first of all, that kind of like extreme white supremacist ideology, I believe, is a form of child abuse. When you indoctrinate children into that ideology, it's as much child abuse for like the white child receiving that indoctrination as it is for, you know, whatever children of color they later abuse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's those children are abused children too. And he was abused by that indoctrination of white supremacist ideology, and he was physically and sexually abused by his own mother. And
right.
He paid that forward. You know, he brought that with him, like the unhealed wounds of the Civil War, the unhealed wounds of his abusive intergenerational trauma in his family, the beliefs of his sundown town that taught him to dehumanize large portions of humanity. You know, it's no wonder that when he you know, he met my mom. My mom was a teenager when she had me. Scottish Canadian heritage, white, had a black child out of wedlock at 17 years old in Catholic Quebec in 1979. And let me tell you, that was like she lost whatever, you know, sort of privilege and place and plenty that she had enjoyed before then. It was like her parents washed their hands of her. They were like, if you don't get rid of this baby, you can't live here anymore. She got kicked out of her house. Her parents got divorced. She wound up in a home for unwed mothers. And she was struggling with mental health issues that her family was in total denial of because of stigma, you know, stigma around mental health. Like, there can't be anything wrong with our child. My birth was a catalyst for a full-blown psychotic break for her and the beginning of her schizophrenia that would not get diagnosed properly for years to come. So she was struggling in this like terrifying world of psychosis without any help, you know, for years. And she was also self-medicating, which didn't help anything. And she had this baby she didn't know how to take care of. And she had a black child and she didn't know, and you hadn't experienced prejudice like that until she had a black child. You know, I mean, it was, I think, shocking to her on so many levels. And she was a baby herself. And he, you know, much older man, you know, she's born in like when's my mom born? I think 1961, 1960. And he's born in 1936.
Right.
You know, and so he was like, he thought he bought us. I really think so. You know, I was taken away from her by Child Protective Services in Montreal when I was less than a year old. And I was in foster care for about 4 years. And during that time, he groomed and courted and married her. And then he had to, you know, at that time when you got taken away by Child Protective Services, you would have to go to court and sort of prove your fitness to get your child back. And that's what he did. And they handed me to him. And that was it. It was the beginning of, it was just before my fifth birthday. And that was the beginning of like 10 years of bondage. Until I ran away from home at 15, you know, but it's like, he really thought, I think, oh, I own this child, you know, it wasn't even fully human to him because his entire community had taught him I wasn't fully human. And it was even enshrined in the Constitution of the U.S. for quite some time, 3/5, you know, not even a whole human.
You know, but the way that you're able to talk about this now, this profound sense of understanding for your father and to some degree your mother as well, it seems like it surpasses. You just gave like an intellectual case, like you intellectually understand why things ended up and like why they did. But it seems like you're at a place now where you've forgiven it to a point where it had to have at some point gone just beyond the intellectual case for why things ended up why they did. Like you at some point have to jump beyond that to get where you are now. Is that correct? Or was it solely an intellectual exercise like you just described right there?
Oh, no. I mean, it took years. It took years for me to get to this point of being able to think about it or talk about it in this way. I mean, it was years of self-harm. It was years of running. It was years where it's rather miraculous that I'm alive. Like, definitely when I was 13 and 14, that was very touch and go. And there were specific things that led to my survival. And the first thing was the birth of my little brother, technically a half-brother, my adoptive father and my mother's son. But he's my brother. I was 7 when he was born. And that was the first saving grace. Because suddenly there was this little baby who needed me more than I needed to die, basically. And I learned about love from him. You know, I loved him completely and he loved me and he needed me. And so that was the first time that I understood the power of imagination, you know, that I was able to comfort him with stories and songs, and we were able to sort of transport that art could transport us out of horrific circumstances that are unbearable. Art helps us do that. I mean, the fact that I was an early reader and I would live inside of books, that helped preserve my my spirit and psyche and mind to a great degree. You know, like I would just go away in my head, whatever was happening to my body. And that made all the difference in the world. To be the escapism of art is incredibly important. You know, it can save your life. It saved my life. And it saved, you know, my brother being born, having that sense of mothering awaken in me, mothering him, also forced me to start trying to love and mother myself to some degree. And then that continued when my adoptive father has two children from a previous marriage, boys, two boys, and they were, you know, already, one was a teen and one was an adult by the time I was on the scene. And the eldest of them ended up having two kids quite young. And when I was 14, those two children, my adoptive niece and nephew came to live with us for about 6 months because the parents were having some struggles. And I stayed home from school that year. That was my ninth grade. And I took care of these kids. And that was life-changing as well, because that was the first time my adoptive father wasn't in my bed, you know, because the babies were. So I suddenly had space to breathe and think and process. And that was when, by the time those kids went home, mothering them and protecting them had led me to the conclusion that I needed to attempt to protect myself, that I had to leave my house, that it wasn't going to change, and I had to leave if I was going to survive. And that was the most painful decision I've ever made, because I couldn't take my little brother with me, you know, when I was 15 and he was 7 or 8, you know, I couldn't take him with me. And that was devastating. And that was the worst. So from 15 to 20, at 15, I was sleeping in graveyards. I was, you know, wandering the mountain in Montreal at all hours of the night. I was staying up in 24-hour cafes with McGill University students and like old guys playing chess. I fell in love for the first time at 15, you know, with another dear friend who was also 15. She was my first love, and she used to, in the wintertime, I would, you know, like sneak into her basement room and sleep until morning, and so I wouldn't freeze to death in Montreal. And eventually, you know, I got like shitty telemarketing jobs and moved in with some other people between, you know, young women between the ages of kind of 15 and 18. And we lived on Rue de Bouillon, around the corner from Leonard Cohen's old place on Rochelle. And Lassa lived down the street, and I'd hear her singing on her balcony. I mean, I was so lucky to be where I was as well in Montreal. You know, all of the things that conspired to kind of preserve me, the art of the city, the fact that there were so many 24-hour places that I could go and kind of take refuge fairly safely. I just, all of these layers of kind of these little blessings that I wouldn't be here without. And at the top of that is art. I mean, it was the escapism of art that allowed me to sort of process and preserve enough to get to the point where I could intellectualize anything down the line.
When I, in the past, have heard people talk about using art to deal with past traumas, I always have assumed that the chief reason behind it is to integrate those past experiences into a life going forward. But hearing you talk right now, I'm sure that was part of it, but hearing you talk right now, it seems like a good amount of it probably had to do with you wanting to provide that kind of art escapism for people who would come after you in the same situation. Would that be accurate?
Yes, definitely. As a kind of a, like, you can survive, because I did. And I will never forget. I mean, the first time I heard Tracy Chapman was like this revelatory thing for me. One of the things with my adopted father, deeply racist, obviously, and he would talk about the inferiority of all things black, and he would not allow us to listen to basically modern music of any kind. We listened to mostly Baroque. Sometimes he was feeling really wild, romantic era classical music. And that was pretty much it. And so I really didn't know. And the books in our home, you know, it was the Western canon, it was all white male writers for the most part. He made an exception for the Bronte sisters. I did not know that someone who looked like me could even make art, really. I just didn't really know that until I went on a road trip when I was 9 years old with my maternal uncle, David, my mom's older brother, and it was a miracle that I was allowed to go. He was supposed to be getting married in Alberta, which is a whole long story. He ended up getting sort of jilted the day before the wedding, but we went on a road trip through the Rocky Mountains of Alberta, and I had never been outside of Montreal. So there were so many layers of kind of revelation of that trip. But he played me Tracy Chapman, on the car tape deck back in those days. I was 89 years old, and he played me that tape, and I will never forget hearing her voice the first time, and in particular the song Behind the Wall, and it struck me so forcibly, like that. Well, first of all, we were the family behind the wall, and that clearly we weren't the only one, you know, and that some people got out. She got out somehow of, you know, I don't know what her personal circumstances were, but the empathy that she sang that song with made it clear to me that she had lived through some stuff herself. And it was just revelatory to hear and see. You know, I remember poring over that little, the folded cassette liners, just looking and like tracing her face, seeing this, you know, beautiful Black woman writing and singing her truth, like unapologetically, was just so unimaginable to me. I had never heard anything like that, you know, at 9 years old. And it was like an opening. It was like a door opening. Like there's a path here somewhere for you, you know?
Definitely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I mean, that's what, when I think about, you know, people, you know, that expression, virtue signaling, mm-hmm. I really dislike that expression, because it's like such a short-sighted, it's complete, the idea like saying something like representation matters, and someone saying, oh, that's virtue signaling. No, it's not. What representation matters really just means is that. It means a really scared, terrorized kid suddenly seeing a possibility, suddenly having the horizon expand. You know, that's all it means. And that's what it was for me the first time I heard Tracy Chapman. And it wasn't that Bach wasn't important in my life. He was, but he was a dead German white man, and I did not think that I could do anything like that. You know?
Allison's experience with writer's block sounded really challenging. But she's in good company when it comes to the syndrome. History's greatest poets have struggled with it, and it sounds like her solution for it jibes with their collected wisdom on the subject, that the only way out is through. To not turn back to earlier works, to not give up and wait for the muse to come, to forge ahead, forward with the work, until the words return through the artist's sheer force of will. There's an iconic piece of work on the subject by none other than Dylan Thomas, entitled On No Work of Words. On no work of words now for 3 lean months, in the bloody belly of the rich year, in the big purse of my body, I bitterly take to task my poverty and craft. To take to give is all. Return what is hungrily given, puffing the pounds of manna up through the dew to heaven. The lovely gift of the gab bangs back on a blind shaft. To lift to leave from treasures of man is pleasing death that will rake at last all currencies of the marked breath and count the taken, forsaken mysteries in a bad dark. To surrender now is to pay the expensive ogre twice. Ancient woods of my blood, dash down to the nut of the seas if I take to burn or return this world, which is each man's work. The Working Songwriter is all about how the hell people make this work for themselves. You've been a working artist for going on 2 decades now. Now you're completely, in some ways, reinventing yourself, both with the name that you're recording under and how you're writing and how you're putting it out. Can you describe how the process of putting together this latest record, just from a business aspect, and how you're putting it out and what you've learned in the past that you're applying here that's helping you?
Well, I think that my entire journey as an artist has been about chosen community and finding the people that I resonate with and who I can relate to and who see and hear and value me. And that has been like basically the continuous thread throughout every project I've been part of, and every new musical or artistic venture that I throw myself into. And this has been no different for the solo record. I mean, it started with applying for some funding, actually. And that was, I remember distinctly, we were at the airport on the way home from the Edmonton Folk Fest in 2017. And, or maybe it was 2017. And we ran into Tamara Cater, Kai Cater's mom. Kai Cater, wonderful songwriter, banjoist from Montreal as well, actually. And we ran into her, and she was asking us, this was with Birds, and she was asking us about Canadian arts funding and whether we ever applied for any of it. And we said no, and she was like, you really ought to. You're eligible for lots of things because I'm Canadian. And so we kind of put that in the back of my mind. And I knew that I wanted to start just exploring some more kind of writing, maybe personal writing, maybe a solo record. I wasn't sure, after the Our Native Daughters project, which we recorded the Songs of Our Native Daughters album in 2018. And it came out in February of 2019. And it had this kind of momentum that gathered behind it that was sort of surprising to all of us. And it was also sort of the beginning of a deeper journey of inquiry to me into just the intergenerational trauma I was talking about. And I decided to apply for a grant, just a writing grant, like a demo grant. And I found out that I had gotten it from the Canada Council of the Arts, because we're really lucky in Canada, we still have some arts funding. And I found out that I had received those grants kind of right before Americana Fest, here in Nashville in 2019. And all of my sort of chosen community of musicians and family and friends were in town right around that time. Everyone that I kind of hoped would collaborate with me on the exploration. And so we ended up, 4 days magically came free at the Sound Emporium. Dan Nobler, who produced the record, had the time free after Americana Fest. And so we just, and the songs were just brand new. I mean, JT and I were finishing Joyful Motherfuckers like the morning that we went into the studio. And the others were written basically between, I mean, some were, the beginnings of were written in April of 2019, Little Rebirth was. But the first one where I was consciously aware, like, maybe this was in fact a whole cycle that I was trying to excavate. That song, Fourth Day Prayer, the beginning of it was on the Our Native Daughters tour bus in July of 2019 on an overnight drive to the Newport Folk Festival. And Ida had an accident. She was sleeping in the bunk next to me. And the bus driver was this kind of really cantankerous guy who didn't like humans all that much, definitely not children. And he wouldn't stop the bus for me to get a change of clothes. So I was, pulled out a merch shirt and got that on her. And I had my bathing suit from, some river stop we'd done earlier that day. It was just ridiculous, lying in the bunk in my bathing suit with my kid and kind of putting a towel over the accident. And I was just laughing to myself because I thought, well, this is my worst problem now, a grouchy driver and my kid having an accident on this tour bus surrounded by people I adore, who adore me and my kid. Like, I couldn't have imagined that, when I was 15 and running scared. I just could not have imagined this was in my future. And that's where that line came from. These are the best years of your life. If I believed it, I'd have died. But something told me that they lied, so I survived. And it's like, you know, people will say that to teenagers all the time. These are the best years of your life. And I truly would have died if I believed it. If there wasn't some inkling that, no, there's more. There's more than this somewhere, somehow. And that was when, I don't know, I just felt that was the beginning of the thread of, I need to tell this whole story, and I need to tell it as though I love this character, just the way I love any of the troubled protagonists of any of the books, you know, that I adore. And it's that's the hardest, I think, for as a survivor and a writer to give your own story that same kind of love and attention. It's hard, and I felt that I needed to do it as a. And because I'm a mom, and because I know that I'm unfortunately 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men, 1 in 2, you know, trans or intersex or non-binary folks that has experienced similar things. It's a pandemic, you know, it's a pandemic that's been with us for too long, and it's not going to stop unless we stop it, you know.
It's interesting, you mentioned, you know, that line first coming up and you kind of realizing at the time, like, oh, this is going to be the start of a song cycle. This is going to be the start of a record. Sometimes, I guess people who aren't songwriters can't understand what it feels like to first get your fingers on a thread that when you start to pull it out, you're like, holy shit, I think this thread is like 100 miles long.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Because we're also used to pulling threads that are like an inch long out. You're like, oh, damn, another inch long thread. But
yeah.
But, you know,
this was like, oh no, this is a long thread. It could be a whole quilt. I don't know. And it was amazing. Well, the eerie thing, though, too, was like, so that was my first separation from JT, and JT's first separation from Ida and I. You know, because we went and did this big Native Daughters tour, and Ida came. We brought all the kids. It was absolute madness. We had 6 children, 2 nannies, a film crew from the Smithsonian,
wow.
You know, the 4 of us, and all the amazing, you know, the whole band, Jamie Dick on the drums, Jason Cypher on the bass, Francesco Teresi on the keys, and then a front of house, you know, monitor guy, like the film crew, the net. I mean, it was Layla and I and the 6 kids and the 2 nannies on the kid bus.
Okay.
With the rest of the adults on the adult bus. And both of these buses should have been retired in 1970, as far as I could tell, but they were somehow still on the road. It was like, you know, it was derelict. It was very, very funny, these buses. And there was like, you know, when we saw them, we were all like, oh no, this can't be right. And it was too late. Like those were the only buses left.
Right.
We did this tour. The children got trapped in the bus at one point. There was like a, you know, an electrical sliding door between the bunks and the front room of the bus. And it, the mechanic, you know, when it wasn't mechanics, the electronics spritzed out, and the kids got trapped on one side of the door and we got trapped on the other. And
oh,
it was just these ridiculous things that make me laugh so much. And when I watched the documentary, I'm like, oh, we didn't put that part in the documentary. But, you know, it was just so wonderfully like almost falling apart at every turn. But we somehow finished the tour and kept it together and started writing this record. And I sent JT the snippet of what I was working on. He was in New Hampshire at the time, having like just a writer, you know, just writing for a few days at a friend's cabin. And he was freaking out because he'd been having dreams about me and my childhood me, and basically channeling that history before I called him to say, this is really strange. I think I have to write this. And he had written, I had written all the verses, basically, of Fourth Day Prayer, and he had written the chorus. You know, like, and didn't know that I was, I mean, it was one of the more, for us, the two of us, one of the more intense things we've done together.
And it's interesting, you know, that it would happen, it's interesting that it would happen with you guys being apart for the first time, because you'd spent so much damn time together over the preceding decade, that as soon as you're apart, you end up working on 2 halves of maybe the same project? Is that what you're kind of alluding
to? Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It was one of the more I don't know, surreal, but also like strangely for us, maybe the most intimate work we've ever done is this record.
It's really cool. It must be really cool. I don't know what it's like because I've never experienced it, but it must be really cool to have a creative partner that is willing to lean in to something that's so personal to you rather than necessarily to him, because that's one of the most difficult things, it seems like to me, for a creative partnership is for it to change over time and to just continue, for it to like reiterate itself. And at a certain point, it seems like to me that the only way that that is possible for at different times, one of the two partners to say like, all right, well, let's forget about me for a second and let's zero in on you.
Yeah. And that's exactly what he did, which I think you're right, is really is an incredibly generous and challenging thing to do, you know, and to be so 100% supportive of it. And, you know, it's remarkable. And it's just a testament to what a beautiful human I married, you know, he's the best. He's the best dad and he's the best husband. He just is. And he's the best co-writer in the world because that is exactly it. It's not ego ever. That is a fascinating thing about JT. And I've learned so much about what you're talking about, the process of songwriting. He has never been precious about it.
Right.
He has never been waiting for inspiration to strike. He is like a Brill Building, Tin Pan Alley. Like, you go to work, you work every day. You work at your craft every day, no matter how shitty and uninspired you feel. No matter how terrible you think what you're writing is, you write every day. Mm. You know, and I feel like that, learning that from him, you know, as a, just his work ethic is something that I have tried to incorporate and adopt in my own practice. And it has been life-changing. I mean, it was part of helping me get out of that writer's block that I was in. I went through a really intense writer's block right before the Our Native Daughters project, like after Ida was born, for about 4 years, really. Like, I barely could finish a song. I was mostly writing just like little lullabies and, you know, children's like sort of doggerel, like just little things to entertain Ida. And I honestly felt like at a certain point, maybe I'm not a songwriter anymore. Mm. And JT would never let me do it. He was like, that's ridiculous. You're just, this is a huge, you know, for me, motherhood, like silenced me for a little bit. It's like, it was so overwhelming. I just got really quiet for a while there. And for him, it was the opposite. Becoming a father was like, I have to write 5 songs a day. he was on fire. Like, I have to support the family and I do that by writing songs.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And he really did. He just had a creative explosion. You know, he wrote I wrote maybe 2 songs on the Real Midnight record. He wrote all of the American Flowers record. He wrote Love and Wartime. I mean, again, I co-wrote a tiny little bit, but barely, you know, he was pulling the weight on all of that. And it was really like, that was the other gift of it, which he was also writing for me specifically, like writing me out of my funk, basically, you know, and writing for my voice and completely internalizing, like really tapping into his inner feminine in a way that I just think is remarkable. I think there's very few writers that can do what he does. And, you know, he helped pull me out of it. And then the Native Daughter, being in when Rhiannon, you know, our Native Daughters, Rhiannon Giddens, Layla McCalla, and Sophia and I, and when Rhiannon invited me to be part of it, I was actually really worried about, you know, am I going to be able to contribute or am I just going to continue to be mute, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was like, it kicked the floodgates open. You know, we got there initially from the way she had described it. I thought it would be a little bit more like we were excavating and reclaiming kind of songs from the minstrel era or doing some rewrites of that. But what ended up happening was just us writing a bunch of new material together and individually. And it was like we wrote Moon Meets Sun the first day, Amethyst, Rhiannon and I, and we recorded it the next day, you know, and so on. And so we were writing songs the night before and recording them the next day. And that's how the Our Native Daughters record got made over 10 days. And, you know, I'll never forget that. And I ended up writing a whole bunch of stuff that didn't even, you know, I was writing more than could be even used on that record. And that was sort of the beginning of kind of working through some of the the stuff that I had to work through to get to the outside child songs.
Sounds like you kind of had a fast one pulled on you there. Like, oh no, we're just going to do some old covers from back in the day. And then day two, you're just deep into writing completely original material.
It's just what happened. Like, we got together and we all just had a whole bunch of stuff to say, you know, and that's just sort of what, and the other magical thing about that experience was just how beautifully and easily we were able to co-write. That doesn't always happen, you know?
Yeah.
And Amethyst and I barely knew each other at the beginning of that, you know? And by the end of it, it's like, she's my sister for life. And Layla and I, the same thing. You know, she's all through the pandemic, Layla McKella and Abigail Washburn and I have been having like a weekly check-in, just writer, artist, moms check-in through the pandemic. And it's just been, you know, these are like chosen family of just deep, deep kind of instinctive connection. And, you know, I don't think that Rhiannon even realized the degree to which that would happen. She just didn't, you know, I think she did think, oh, well, it's just what happened when the four of us got together was some deep communion and communication, you know.
This is kind of a weird question, but I'm interested to know if that period that you self-described as writer's block for about 4 years, and then now you're back writing again. Now that it's all over and you're writing songs again and things are going great, was there any utility to that time of not really writing songs or finishing songs? Like, was it, in some ways, was it worth it? Or was it really just like, oh, well, that was just a break of 4 years and now I'm just back and everything's the same as it was before?
No, I think it was part of it. I think I was doing going back to, you know, how am I able to sort of speak intellectually about things that are devastating?
Right.
I think that's part of it. I think I had, when I became a mother, it was like I had to reckon with all of my past. And I think I needed 4 years of really just meditating and processing in silence, you know, of just working through that in silence in my own heart and mind. And it's been one of the most challenging things for me becoming a mother is reconciling all of that history and is my sheer, I never thought I would be a mother. I never wanted to be a mother because I didn't want to risk bringing forward any of what I experienced. And I know how these cycles work and I know how insidious they are. And I was terrified of somehow bringing that forward or of my child suffering through the schizophrenia that my mother has suffered through,
right.
You know, and I was terrified of that, of paying any of it forward. And it started to change, you know, JT and I, when we had Ida, we'd been already been together for 7 years, you know, now we're coming up on 15 years together.
Mm-hmm.
And I always knew he wanted to be a father. And so it was like, as we got more committed to spending our life together, I realized I would have to make, you know, decide that, and because it's a deal breaker, of course, you know,
right.
If one person knows they want to be a parent and the other is dead set against it.
Right.
And that was when, and that was actually the beginning of my journey to find my paternal family, was as JT and I got more serious, realizing like, well, I need to know at least what's on the other side of my heritage too. Like, I don't even know if there's heart disease, you know, is there cancer?
Right.
Is there also mental, you know, intergenerational mental health issues on the other side too? I don't know. And, you know, so it was like when I first started doing that outreach, it was more almost like medical curiosity, you know, like, can I, you know, what are the risks? Like, what roulette am I engaged in here? If we do have a baby, or, you know, it was
right.
Like, I just needed to know that. And then it turned out that my paternal family wanted to know me, you know, that it was this, that my biological father had, you know, my mom had told him when I was taken away from her by Child Protective Services, she had told him that she'd given me up in a closed adoption, you know, and of course he believed her. And they were both kids. He was briefly in Montreal studying, but he was from Grenada. He went back to Grenada, you know, before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a high school fling, you know. So it was, and then he lived through a whole world of trauma because, of course, I mean, a lot of people don't know about this history, but Grenada was invaded by Reagan, you know, in 82. And it was, you know, Maurice Bishop was killed and I mean, the CIA went in and made it a so-called safe zone. It was a casualty basically of the Cold War. You know, it was like, it was the invasion happened because Castro helped Grenada pay for a commercial airport, not even a military airport, a commercial one. And that was seen as provocation enough to, you know, to have the war action / not war action. Nobody cares. Nobody's looking at this little island nation. So anyway, it was, you know, my biological father was living through very intense times when I was in foster care and then being adopted by this extremely sick person. You know?
Now, you said you needed that 4 years in some way to learn this history, to become a mom. And now you're living in a writing stage that's informed by all that. Has that changed your relationship with the music that you created before that time? Like, do you look at that music in a new way now, for good or for ill?
That's an interesting question. You know, I don't know that I don't really look back very often at the music I've made in the past. I don't listen back, you know, to music that I've put out very rarely. I think, I don't know that it's changed it. I see it as an evolution, you know, each new phase of, and I think it's that way for most writers. I don't know about for you, Joe, but like that, you hear, you know, you can hear, there are things that sometimes like, oh, I certainly wouldn't do that now. but it's an honest journey. You know, I think of, and that is all I can really hope for, I think, as an artist, is to be as sort of honest as I can in what I am putting out, and to be as, to kind of craft what I'm writing to the best of my abilities at the time, you know, and try to have that, if it feels resonant and true to me, then hopefully it can feel resonant and true to somebody else as well, which is, you know, we share music in the hopes of making some kind of connection, you know?
Yeah. My relationship to my past music is only informed by whether people will pay to listen to it or not. That's a whole other thing.
I know. Oh my gosh. Just that, I mean, this time, right, the pandemic and the loss of all of our jobs, and not just ours, but so many, I think there are so many people and I've only ever lived extensively in the U.S. and Canada, that, you know, North Americans who think of themselves as like, we're doing well, we're fine, we're like middle-class people. Almost everybody I know is working poor. You know, mm-hmm. Almost everybody I know is a working class musician. And when the gigs dry up for a year, you don't have savings in the bank to cover a year of that, of loss. And you don't have, like, we certainly didn't. And that was part of this year. I mean, when you're talking about just the, like, the mechanics of, like, how do you keep going? We weren't sure how we were going to keep going. You know, when we were forced to, and we had been, but here's the thing, we had been on this subsistence touring hamster wheel for so long.
Yeah.
To the point where I was getting really depressed, frankly, in 2018 and 2019, because our daughter, when she turned 4, was like, I want to go to school. I don't want to be I don't want to live in the van anymore. I don't want to be on tour anymore. And it was a devastating transition where our family had never been separated. Mm-hmm. To my chosen sister, Anna, came to live with us and was doing some nannying. Our primary income was subsistence touring. And so we couldn't just stop cold turkey because we just didn't have infrastructure to keep, you know, putting food on the table for our kid any other way. And we were we knew, like, this isn't sustainable. It isn't sustainable for us to be separated from our child doing this touring that you just you never feel like it was worth that separation when you come home, you know, or it didn't for us. We just weren't, you know, things hadn't taken off for our band in that way. And we were making a living, but kind of just barely, you know. And it was, every time I had to be separated from our daughter, I was just like, this isn't worth it to me. And it was actually getting to the point where I was like, JT, you should make a solo record. And then, you know, I can stay home and I can teach part-time, or I can, you know, whatever, I can get another gig.
Right.
And not be constantly gone from our child. I mean, it was getting to that point for me. Like, I was getting really really depressed on the road and sort of despairing, and had kind of, you know, had stopped feeling like we're on the cusp of it really getting better.
Right.
Like it no longer felt that way. It felt like we just, those dots just didn't quite ever align for us, you know, in birds. And it was a wild thing to sort of like have the response that our native daughters got,
right,
you know, which was a project that none of us was prepared to even tour in the beginning, you know?
Right.
And then we've since made space for it a little more, but it was like, that was actually in some ways a really hard thing for me, for this kind of one-off thing that we all did and put together in 10 days, having an impact that 7 years of really, really deep, heartfelt, consistent effort hadn't been able to achieve for my other project, you know, was really kind of heartbreaking in a strange way.
Isn't that the way it goes?
Appreciated. Like,
yeah.
I know. It really is. It's the way it goes sometimes. And that was, you know, that was part of the, like, well, we got to do solo records because we can't both be out all
right.
the time anymore. It doesn't make sense.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you did do a solo record, and I'm glad it was you first. And I really appreciate you coming back on the podcast. Thank you, Allie.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always great talking to you, Joe.
This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Allison Russell's latest album is entitled Outside Child, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again, you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.